Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 361, titled Networking. This is being recorded on June 2nd of the year 2002. Continuing our analysis of, in many ways, a number of different topics, but also seeing these through the prism of the events of September 11th and before and afterward, I thought that it would be useful to not only repeat some information from past broadcasts, but to place this information in a context that will be enable us to understand, I think, from a more intelligent viewpoint, some of the events that have been going on. I've seen some drastic oversimplification, probably very understandable under the circumstances. I've also seen many people taking pieces of the whole out of the context in which they exist, and then analyzing the entire event as if it were, from an analytical standpoint, derivative from that isolated piece of the whole. Again, this is probably an understandable stance to take, but I think rather than focusing on, quote, conspiracy, unquote, I think networking is a much more useful concept, and we're going to be talking about some networking, recent and long ago. We're going to be talking about how some of those networks connect up. I also think it's worth understanding the nature of human institutions themselves. It is in the nature of an institution which represents itself publicly and which is hierarchical, and in which people have a vested interest to cover up if a mistake is made. People have reputations, they have resumes, they have investments, whether one is a professor with a university where mistakes are made or perhaps where scandals occur, or whether one is a political figure within an institution in which a scandal occurs, or whether one is a business person or an author or a journalist. It is the nature of institutions to cover up in order to further their own interests, and individuals do much the same thing. And when an individual or an institution has been engaging in networking, the inertia, the institutional inertia, always works, or almost inevitably works, in such a way as to incline the individual and the institution in the direction of cover-up, not necessarily for sinister reasons, but for reasons of profit, for reasons of personal gain, self-esteem, and the motivations that basically propel all of us to one extent or another, or almost all of us, through this world. So with that bit of perhaps condescending and perhaps facile-seeming platitude, let's plunge into some of the information dealing with September 11th or related events. We're going to take a look at some networking that has gone on vis-a-vis the corridors of power, the corridors of finance, the pipelines of oil, and that also have embraced within them some very powerful fascist networks dating all the way back to World War I, stretching through the world of international espionage, the world of the Third Reich, the world of the Underground Reich, and overlapping the world of Islamofascism. Again, that is not to be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist, but there is a powerful element within it that constitutes a form of theocratic fascism. It, in turn, is inextricably linked with the Wahhabi faith, as we have spoken about in the past. One of the primary exponents of the Saudi Arabia-based ultra-extremist Wahhabi faith, of course, has been Osama bin Laden, an individual whose name has not exactly been a stranger to the headlines in recent months. There was a book about bin Laden that has now been recently published in softcover called Holy War Incorporated, subtitled Inside the Secret World of Osama bin Laden. This has been authored by Peter L. Bergen. It has been published in soft cover by Touchstone Books, copyright 2001 and 2002. And the ISBN number is 0-7432-3495-2. This book, Holy War Incorporated by Peter Bergen, has a lot of good information in it. A cautionary note, many of the people who have written about Osama bin Laden, some of the books are better than others, have gone out of their way to diss some of the other authors. I think the situation vis-a-vis September 11th And Osama bin Laden is rather like the story of people grabbing the elephant. One grabs the tail, one grabs the trunk, one grabs the leg, and each think they have a piece of the whole. So I would caution gently against authors dissing of one another's work. That, again, is sort of the institutional selfishness that tends to perpetuate itself, or the individual or professional selfishness. But this is a very good book. It also finds fault with some other works that I think are also equally, or in some cases, more valuable. So with that cautionary note about this recent and important book, Holy War Incorporated by Peter Bergen, we're going to read about a law firm that handles legal advice for the Saudi bin Laden group. That is the Saudi-based construction conglomerate of the bin Laden family. The SICO, the Saudi investment company, is Islam bin Laden's very important European-based bin Laden financial operation. There are connections of many members of the bin Laden family to al-Qaeda and to the milieu of September 11th, their disclaimers to the contrary notwithstanding. Now, the law firm that apparently, according to Peter Bergen, is doing legal work or has provided legal advice to the Saudi bin Laden group is none other than the law firm Sullivan & Cromwell. Reading from Holy War Incorporated, furthermore, the family company maintained a satellite office in Maryland during the 1990s, employs a public relations agency in Manhattan, and receives legal advice from the white shoe law firm Sullivan and Cromwell. The characterization of Sullivan and Cromwell as a white shoe law firm refers to the old boy Eastern establishment, and indeed Sullivan and Cromwell, now a law firm which has been eclipsed by many other of the powerful law firms in the country, but Sullivan and Cromwell obviously still very much involved with some of the Wall Street finance, Middle East oil, intelligence, and fascist-connected networking that has always characterized its operations. Sullivan and Cromwell has as its two best-known partners Allen and John Foster Dulles, and we're going to review some of the networking that Sullivan and Cromwell has been involved in by way of understanding how some of these relationships evolve, and also by way of perhaps giving us more depth on some of these relationships, that depth hopefully enabling people not only to explain what is going on, but perhaps to circumvent the not particularly useful discussion about whether or not one does or does not believe in conspiracies. Networking is the name of the game, and there's a lot of it going on, and it is the nature of networks to cover up misdeeds that have taken place in their midst, precisely so the networks can continue. That is a very important concept, and in my opinion, much of the covering up that has taken place in connection with September 11th has taken place for that reason. And within the context of that institutional slash networking covering up, to incorrectly conjugate that, one finds some very sinister networks indeed, networks which in a mafia-like fashion have exploited that for their own sinister ends. Read the Underground Reich, and I've spoken about that many times in the past. We're going to turn now to a book that we've used many times in the past. That's called The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by former Justice Department investigator John Loftus and his co-author Mark Ahrens. It was published in hard and soft cover by the St. Martin's Press. The soft cover ISBN number is 0-312-156480, copyright 1994. John Loftus, by the way, has filed a lawsuit, which in turn has led to some Treasury Department and Justice Department raids on some institutions which have been alleged to be involved in September 11th. These institutions overlap the milieu of Al-Taqwa and Naba Management, one of the Islamo-fascist institutions that has emerged in connection with the investigation into September 11th. That is an institution with roots dating back to the Muslim Brotherhood and with many overt fascist elements involved in it. It goes to the highest corridors of power in Saudi Arabia and in the United States and within the milieu of the petroleum industry, and those networks in turn heavily overlap the historical milieu of fascism and the Underground Reich. Reviewing from The Secret War Against the Jews, Barenmond, Sullivan, and Cromwell, its work as counsel for the Saudi Bin Laden Group. Bear in mind the fact that Sullivan and Cromwell was one of the law firms that, among other things, handled some of the work for the Bush family for the investing that took place in the Third Reich. And bear in mind King Ibn Saud, who was a good friend of Osama bin Laden's father, Mohammed, and that began some of the networking on the Saudi side of this arrangement. Turning to the secret war against the Jews, this period, stretching from the end of World War I to just after the end of World War II, was characterized by three very evil men: Jack Filby, a British spy, Ibn Saud, his Arab protege, and parenthetically a good friend of Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father and the founder of the family industrial operation, and Alan Dulles, an American spy and Wall Street lawyer specializing in international finance, and parenthetically one of the key partners in Sullivan and Cromwell. Continuing. The racist nature of their secret war against Zionism does not appear in history books for a simple reason. Jack Filby later was paid by Western oil companies to write pro-Arab propaganda disguised as history. Ibn Saud is remembered as the glorious Arab leader who unified Saudi Arabia and led the richest oil region in the world into partnership with the West. Filby, if he is remembered at all, has the reputation of a scholarly British Arabist overshadowed by his son Kim, the infamous Soviet double agent. Jack Filby has become an obscure footnote to the history of the Cold War, but his legacy was far from minor. He is one of the lesser-known but most influential persons in the modern history of the Middle East, the renegade British intelligence agent who plucked an obscure terrorist out of the desert and helped to make him the king of Saudi Arabia. Ibn Saud was very much his creation. Filby stole the information from British intelligence files that engineered Saudi control over the holiest shrines of the Muslim world. Jack Filby and Ibn Saud betrayed the British Empire and made the American oil companies economic masters of the region. The man who helped them do it was Alan Dulles, an American spy who had befriended Filby while he was coordinating American intelligence gathering in the Middle East in the first half of the 1920s. Between them, these three men built the very foundations of the modern Middle East. They were the architects of the oil weapon, the instigators of war, the manipulators of history. More important, Filby's and Ibn Saud's political and philosophical allegiance was to Nazi Germany, while much of Dulles's profits came from the same source. Now, we're going to take a look at some of the networking that Sullivan and Cromwell has been involved in within the corridors of the American power elite and the petroleum industry and through the development of fascism in Europe. One should note that over the course of events, there is a multiplicity of motivations, and some of those are explained, I think, quite nicely here by the authors as they describe Sullivan and Cromwell. One should understand, again, the nature of networking and the institutional inertia, particularly where significant profits are involved, but not necessarily only when significant profits are involved in the realm of intellectual production, journalism, political research. Often mere ego can be a very, very powerful motivator indeed, where one is inclined to either puff up one's own work or diss somebody else's simply in order to further one's own reputation, self-esteem, and perhaps profit. Sullivan and Cromwell and networking. The authors, Loftus and Ahrens, write, "Before the United States had a formal intelligence service, it had Sullivan and Cromwell. According to some accounts, this firm helped organize the seizure of land for the Panama Canal. Later, it represented the French government, several titans of British industry, and, more important for this story, most of the leading banks of pre-war Nazi Germany. The 1930s were not the first time that one of the Dulles boys had represented German money. During And after World War I, Foster tried desperately to keep Kaiser Wilhelm II's assets from being seized by the U.S. Alien Property Custodian. As a member of the U.S. War Trade Board, Foster Dulles had good sources of information. German bribes went all the way to the Attorney General. In defending the crooked Attorney General, Harry Doherty has tried... In defending the crooked Attorney General, Harry Doherty, his trial counsel pointed out that there was a bigger crook behind the bribery scandal, the lawyer John Foster Dulles, who, quote, strutted about the peace conference promoting himself as Secretary of State Lansing's nephew, unquote, while carrying a bag, unquote, looking for a bribe, misdirecting his client and comporting himself overall as a man who should be disbarred. Unquote. That again quoting Harry Doherty's trial lawyer. And continuing, of Sullivan and Cromwell partner Foster Dulles, Allen's brother, and by the way, ultimately, Secretary of State under Eisenhower when Allen Dulles was director of the CIA. Unfortunately, Foster was allowed to continue the practice of law, and as a reward for his services, he became the representative of several major German companies such as IG Farben, which owned huge blocks of stock in American oil companies. Farben later became infamous as the holder of the patent for the poison gas used at Auschwitz and for working thousands of Jews to death as slave laborers. Foster's dream was to make the world one big monopoly controlled by his German and American clients. In 1934, Dulles helped draft the agreements establishing the international cartels, joint ventures, and market sharing among the Belgians, the British Imperial Chemical Industries, and IG Farben. As discussed in Chapter 2, it was agreements such as that signed by the Rockefeller-controlled Standard Oil Company of New Jersey with IG Farben that helped the Third Reich to gain such important advances in the development of synthetic rubber and gasoline. By the way, parenthetically, I've discussed those cartel agreements at considerable length in Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, that was recorded on May 23rd of 1980 and is available from Spitfire, about which I will tell you more later in the program. Continuing. In return, Farben became a shareholder in the New Jersey Oil Company, second only to John D. Jr. himself, that of course being Standard Oil of New Jersey. Sullivan and Cromwell seemed to have connections everywhere. It was the original revolving door between the government and Wall Street, and as we explain in Chapter 10, after World War II, the revolving door became a way of life for the men who populated the oil companies and the espionage world. By the time the team of Ronald Reagan and George Bush took over the White House in 1981, it was impossible to tell where private interests ended and public duties began and ended as well. That, of course, the first George Bush. Continuing. Allen Dulles had joined Sullivan and Cromwell after quitting the State Department in 1926. His brother Foster had previously served with State Department intelligence, and Allen was on the board of a leading German bank. Foster was a director of IG Farben. They dealt in millions and traded with nations as equals. In fact, they taught many of the 20th century robber barons how to rob. The Dulles brothers were the ones who convinced American businessmen to avoid U.S. government regulation by investing in Germany. It began with the Versailles Treaty, in which they played no small role. After World War I, the defeated German government promised to pay war reparations to the Allies in gold, but Germany had no gold. It had to borrow the gold from Sullivan and Cromwell's clients in the United States. Nearly 70% of the money that flowed into Germany during the 1930s came from investors in the United States, many of them Sullivan and Cromwell clients. Some of the biggest American financial houses, such as Morgan AC and Chase, also invested heavily in Germany after World War I. In return for their gold, the American clients received bonds and promissory notes backed by shares of stock in Swiss holding companies that owned stock in German banks. These banks, in turn, owned the stock of major German corporations, which in turn owned some of the most valuable industrial patents in the world. In fact, the German bankers had almost created a worldwide high-tech monopoly in and of themselves. American companies such as DuPont and General Motors were more than willing to swap gold for patent rights at bargain basement prices. There was even talk of setting up a worldwide patent cartel in Germany so that the American investors could escape the strictures of the U.S. antitrust laws. It was a heady time. When the price of the mark stabilized and the German economy started to revive during the 1930s, the profits were enormous. The Dulles brothers looked like geniuses. Their Dawes plan of recycling U.S. gold so that Germany could meet its international reparations payments while rebuilding its domestic industry was a stunning success, at least for a while. Under the plan, the United States lent Germany the money to pay Britain and France their war reparations. In turn, Britain and France repaid the United States. As the biographer of the Dulles family, Leonard Mosley, has noted, financially speaking, it was a mad sort of merry-go-round, but it gave the statesmen a breathing space, unquote. Perhaps it was only a coincidence, but it also made for big profits for the brothers' clients. The German economy began to boom while the United States was in the early years of the Depression. That was hardly surprising since so much desperately needed American capital had been shunted off to Dulles clients in Germany. These German clients were mostly not Nazis, at least not originally. Most were conservative Catholic monarchists who believed in the traditions of the Kaiser, Prussian nobility, and the honor of the German officer corps. They hated the chaotic liberals who ruled the Weimar Republic. Most of their money went into moderate or center-right political parties. Skipping down. If Hitler wanted a bigger share of the vote in 1933, he had to go after a much bigger source of funding. In January of 1932, Hitler met in Dusseldorf with a group of 25 German industrialists. This was the turning point for the Nazi Party. Without sufficient funding, they would go down to defeat in 1933 as a lunatic fringe. With heavy financial backing, the Nazis could win a sufficiently substantial minority to obtain a share of power in the government coalition. Hitler told the industrialists what they wanted to hear. If they helped the Nazis increase their vote in 1933, it would be the last election they would ever have to worry about. There would be no more elections, no more problems with unions, no more anti-business liberals. When asked how he would handle inflation, he replied, "With concentration camps," unquote. Hitler would solve unemployment by throwing out the Jews. His words brought the house down. The industrialists immediately pledged 3 million marks. Perhaps 3 million marks was small change, but it is an axiom among politicians that the early donations are the most valuable. The members of the Dusseldorf Industrial Club in 1932 gave Hitler small but significant contributions when he needed them the most. Among the contributors was the manager of Giesche, Germany's largest zinc producer. His company was a client of Alan Dulles, so was another 1932 contributor, I.G. Farben. Before 1932, the Nazis had conducted a vicious propaganda campaign against Farben, quote, as an exploitive tool, unquote, of money-mighty Jews. In 1932, two I.G. Farben officials met secretly with Hitler at his home in Munich to try to end the campaign. A deal was struck. In return for the election donations, Hitler halted the campaign and promised to keep tariff protection after he won power. A sigh of relief went up at the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which stood to lose millions if Hitler kept his word and dismantled its partner. Following Hitler's triumph and consolidation, I.G. Farben led the way among the German corporate world, adapting itself to the Nazi ideology and purging itself of undesirable, unquote, i.e. Jewish elements. Again quoting, "By 1937 and 38, it was no longer an independent company, but rather an industrial arm of the German state and fully Nazified," unquote. Alan Dulles was pleased. With clients like Farben, there were mega profits to be made all round, provided, of course, that one was prepared to abandon the Jews. And skipping down, It should not be a surprise that the Dulles brothers and their friends also represented the helpful Swiss banks which, quote, loaned, unquote, the buyback money to their German clients. As collateral, the Swiss banks received stock in German banks that now controlled, on paper at least, the holdings of the major German corporations. The net effect was to use Swiss banking secrecy as a shield to prevent Hitler from realizing that the American and British investors still pulled the strings behind the scenes. In fact, it was Hitler's bank disclosure law of 1933 that forced a flood of German money over the border into Switzerland. In 1934, the Swiss made disclosure of bank accounts a crime. Some historians believe that the Swiss Shield Law had a more nefarious purpose than protecting American-owned businesses from Hitler. The Swiss bank laws also kept the Dulles brothers' clients away from the prying eyes of the American Justice Department with its strict laws against monopolies, trusts, and cartels. Apart from being illegal, helping the Nazi cartels dominate world trade was against U.S. foreign policy. Although the United States was not yet at war with Germany in 1939, it took a dim view of neutral, unquote, American businessmen who acted in favor of the Third Reich. Still, for two heady years, the Dulles clients had the best of both worlds. Between September 1939 and December 1941, American investors structured their multinational holdings to legally make a profit on both sides of the war. As long as the United States remained officially neutral, such conduct was technically legal or at least offered a plausible defense. John Foster Dulles remained on the board of I.G. Farben. His brother and law partner Allen remained on the board of the Schroeder Bank, along with a scar-faced representative of the SS. And we'll talk more about Sullivan and Cromwell and some of the networking with the Bush family alluded to earlier, and we will proceed to the present. The various tapes that I've done over the years, the various programs, are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. They can be reached at mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. The two most recent half-hour For the Record segments are available for approximately a week on Real Audio on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. By the time the programs are up, there are detailed, annotated descriptions of the programs available on the Spitfire website. There are also links in the descriptions about September 11th to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM. These have the For the Record programs available for download and or streaming on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word. Older programs available at a longer URL. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 361, Networking, being recorded on June 2nd of 2002. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.